So yeah, I'm really excited to be introducing Chinni Gall to you today. So Chinni did her PhD at University of Zurich with Marta Manzer, where she looked at how meerkat groups communicate and coordinate with each other, such as things as how they position themselves in groups, how they're coordinate using vocalizations, and how their coordination is affected by environmental conditions. Chinni has also she has very broad interests and has worked on a lot of different systems in the past. They range from studying the historical response of the city of Zurich to a outbreak of Zurich in of an outbreak of syphilis in 1496. So actually seems much more relevant today than when I initially heard about it. And she has also studied ground squirrels with Jennifer Smith, and she has even studied the collective behavior of sunflowers in recent years with Yasmin Moroz. So Chinni is now joining us as a Zukunfts colleague and collective behavior cluster member fellow to work on a really exciting project on the ontogeny of communication and coordination in pheasants and also in chickens, in collaboration with my group and also with Joe Madden at the University of Exeter. I thought I would end with just a few fun facts about Chinni since she's joining our community. So might be useful for you all to know. First of all, Chinni is an avid board gamer and foosball player, which might be especially exciting for the neuro people because I know there's a foosball table up there. Chinni also likes to dance and has done a dancer PhD, which I don't know if she'll show it in her talk, but if not, you can, I think, find it on YouTube. She's also a leading world expert in meerkat collaring, which is very relevant for all of us. And lastly, she's really creative and full of ideas and loves to chat about science. So I'm sure you'll all have wonderful conversations with her about her own work, but also about your work. And she's really somebody that brings a sense of fun to everything she does, including her science. So Chinni, we're really excited to hear your talk and looking forward to hearing from you and looking forward to having you here in Konstanz.
Thank you very much for that really super nice introduction. Thank you very much, Ari, for the introduction. It was really nice. And I'm going to talk today about a lot of the things I did during my PhD. So Ari already hinted at a lot of them, stuff that happened slightly afterwards, but still involving meerkats. Can you hear me? Okay. And then I'm going to talk about some of the plans I have for when I join officially. So first off, I want to thank everybody that helped me during my PhD because I didn't know where to put that slide otherwise. So obviously, especially my supervisor and everybody else involved, workers, volunteers that to make a project. Okay, so if we talk about group coordination, the first thing we usually need, although I changed my mind slightly on it, is an animal group. And animal groups, in a very loose sense of the word, can be defined as individuals of the same species interacting with each other more than with other individuals. Obviously, this holds for same species groups. So I'm going to focus on those kind of groups. And in a lot of groups, individuals are not exactly the same, but they actually vary by, for example, age. They might have different sex. There might be dominance hierarchies within the group. There might be different litters, and so on. And that changes how individuals might potentially see the world and what they need and their preferences. And that might become a problem when individuals have to coordinate and move as a cohesive group. So because individuals have these different traits and preferences where they want to go, they might also really want to disperse. So then maintaining cohesion can again be a problem. One way to get around this problem can be to communicate, where a sender can emit a signal to an attentive receiver, which then can change his behavior and according to the signal. So for example, here the green individual might have said, "Come here," and the blue individual can respond. And I'm personally very interested in acoustic communication, which has the benefits that it can be very local, but it can also be very global and is usually instantaneous. So for example, the orange individual can emit a signal and everybody else can respond. So when you come back to our coordination problem, if we have vocal communication, for example, individuals might be able to maintain cohesion quite well. Okay, so I was really interested in this and I studied this in meerkats. Meerkats are a social mongoose species. Probably a lot of you have heard or seen of them before. They have cooperative breeding and a very clear dominance hierarchy. So the dominant pair breeds and all the rest of the group still helps to rear their offspring. They're very well known for their sentinel system, where an individual during foraging will go on guard and scan the environment for predators. They have territory defense, and most importantly, they're forage in cohesive groups, where importantly, every single individual forages for their own food, mostly invertebrate prey, in the sand that they scrabble and dig for. And that means that they have the head continuously really low down in the sand and don't necessarily see where all the other members of the group are. And that means that they really use vocal communication a lot. And this is what I'm going to focus on in this talk, in the meerkat part. So I studied meerkats in the Kalahari Meerkat Project. It's located in southern Africa, to the north. And you can see it's a dry savanna environment. And you can also see the overview in the Google Earth map. So meerkats use contact calls a lot. They sound like this. And they emit them essentially every couple of seconds while foraging. So you hear this continuous boop, boop, boop through the group. But they emit them depending on a range of different things. So for example, young individuals emit way more calls than old individuals. And the dominant female calls at a higher rate than subordinate individuals. Call rate seems to depend on surroundedness. So if individuals that have more neighbors around them seem to call at higher rates than individuals that are less surrounded. Similarly, with increasing distance to the nearest neighbor, call rate decreases. Although if you're really far away, call rate might increase again, and they might change call type if they really lose contact to the group. We also realized and noticed that at the front of the group, there seem to be more calls emitted than toward the back. And essentially from all these different things where calls, there's lots of calls, less calls, individuals call at higher rates, there seem to be these vocal hotspots emerging. And we were interested whether these areas with a lot of calls being heard from there can be used to maintain cohesion, and whether they really are used by meerkats to maintain cohesion. And to test this, we did an experiment where we played back calls from the back and the front of the group. We did this for 20 minutes in 8 different meerkat groups. And we played back calls of 4 subordinate individuals and background noise as a control. Throughout the experiment, we maintained a distance of 2 to 5 meters to the closest individual. And here, because I forgot to mention it earlier, I should mention that we work on habituated meerkat groups. So these kind of experiments are possible because the meerkats don't freak out and run away, but they're habituated to the presence of experimenters in the wild. Okay, so during the experiment, we maintained this distance of 2 to 5 meters to the nearest individual for the speakers. The speaker was attached to the experimenter on like the right shin height. And that meant that if individuals moved toward the speaker, we would slowly move backwards and that way elongate the group. So if they use these simulated vocal hotspots, we hope to split the group in two. Throughout the experiment, every 2 minutes roughly, we estimated the length of the group, the width of the group, the gap size between potential subgroups, if there were any, and the average nearest neighbor distance to control gap size width. Okay, so what did we find? Here you can see a plot where you have the time of the experiment on the x-axis, so every 2 minutes, and then you have the length of the group on y-axis. And in red is the close call condition, and in white the background noise. And you can really see that the length of the group elongated over time throughout the experiment. If you look at the width of the group, there's no change between the different conditions. They're the same as expected. We didn't try to widen them. And then if we look at gap size, we see that we actually managed to split them into 2 subgroups. But you can also see they came back together. That's usually because meerkats are not quite as stupid. So they realized that they were split and then would call and then they would all run together. Okay, so that seems, so meerkats really seem to use these vocal hotspots for group cohesion, but there's a lot of things that remain unclear. Mainly, for example, because juvenile individuals call at higher rates than adults. So you might think that, okay, do they influence the group movement way more than adults? Which would be maybe not really sensible because they're way less experienced. It might also be that individuals can distinguish who a call came from. So maybe if a subordinate individual gives a call or a dominant individual, there might be a difference. And there's a lot of things that can be still looked in and it would be really nice. And for this, it's necessary to really know where individuals are and how they call. And Ari and her group are looking into this, specifically Baptiste. So keep your eye on everything they do because it's going to be super interesting. Okay. So coming back to the meerkat project itself, I told you that it is a dry savanna environment. And that means that it has a very unpredictable environment in terms of resources. And obviously, previously I showed you just meerkats, how they move, and they use these vocal hotspots, and it's really nice. But it actually, movement doesn't only depend on who's calling and from where, but also on how resources might be distributed in space, because obviously they move to find resources and food. So if we have a lot of food in the environment here, you can see the triangles, they're supposed to be food. If we put our group in and they forage, they can maintain cohesion fairly easily because there's food everywhere. So maintaining cohesion should be actually easy. If we have very extreme conditions and there's very little food, maintaining cohesion might really be a challenge because every individual will have to space out to find the necessary resources. And we were interested in this as well. And we looked at the Kalahari, and the Kalahari being this dry savanna has wet conditions where there's a lot of rain, and these are summer periods. So Kalahari being in the south, summers from October to February roughly. And we have wet years, there's a lot of rain. When it rains a lot for the Kalahari. And temperatures are high because it's summer, but it's not too bad. Then there's dry years when it rains by a factor of 10 less than in wet years. And you can also see the temperature is a bit higher than during wet years. And then we had one extreme drought in recent years when it nearly didn't rain at all. And the temperatures, even the minimum temperature, is a degree higher than in other years. And you can also see that it really changes the vegetation. So when it's wet, there's a lot of vegetation. Compared to the other years in summer, when the other grasses that are there, there's a specific type of grass that doesn't grow when it's not raining enough. So what does this mean for meerkats? So it means that if you have normal, in this case, normal for me is dry conditions, an individual can emit a signal and it has very little sound attenuation and there's very little constraint on the spacing between individuals. If it's very wet, there's a lot of grass growing. And that means that there is a direct effect on signal perception simply through the sound attenuation through the grass. And to alleviate that, individuals can either call at higher rates to attract the attention of their receivers, or individuals can just move. Both the sender and the receiver can just move closer because there's so much food that it's not really a problem. And that might be better because you also might be better at being safer from predators. If we have a lot of sun, it's not raining, it's very dry. There's this constraint of spacing potentially if there's very little food in the environment. And that means that there is no direct effect on the perception, but because individuals are far away, there's this indirect effect on signal perception. So the only way that was really feasible is by changing the signal, either the structure or the frequency. And here we mainly focused on the frequency of the signals. So we predicted that when we look at these different years that we have that I showed you before in the table, that body condition of individuals should go down from the wet to the driest conditions, and the same with foraging success. And we looked at these two indirect measures because it's very difficult to measure the direct distribution of resources in the Kalahari for meerkats. So we tried pitfall traps and everything in the past, but it didn't seem to work. We looked at the movement speed of groups as well, and we predicted that that would increase with increasing dryness, simply because individuals might be faster from moving from one patch to the other. And we thought maybe that means that also they get out of each other's hearing range quicker. We predicted that the number of group splits should increase with increased dryness, simply because of this difficulty to maintain cohesion when individuals have to space out more. And we predicted that nearest neighbor distance should increase with increasing extreme conditions. And finally, we predicted that close call rate should increase in the drought conditions, but not in the other conditions. Okay, so before I tell you the results, I want to first show you how data is collected for you to better understand what kind of data we had. So at the Kalahari Meerkat Project, when you go to meerkat group, you go before the group gets up in the morning to the burrow. Once the meerkat group gets up, it gets weighed with a little egg and water because they're habituated, they will get into the scale. You can weigh each one of them. And then when they start foraging, usually the volunteers take a GPS point every 15 minutes at the center of the group. And at the same time, they will collect all kind of ad-lib data on dominance interactions, but also whether there's group splits and all these kind of behaviors. And they'll do that for about 3 hours until the group starts resting in summer because it's really hot. And then before the group really starts resting, they'll weigh them again. And then after 3 hours, when they left the group, came back, and the group starts foraging again, we'll pick them up again and collect the same kind of data until the evening when the weights are taken again. And here I'm ignoring the weights data for the evening, but yeah, just for your information. So from the long-term data we had, this data was kind of collected over the last more than 20 years. We looked at the morning weight and as a measure for body condition and weight gain between morning and lunch as a measure of foraging success. We looked at the speed of the group from these 15-minute GPS point data and the frequency of group splits, which is recorded during these ad-lib sessions. We also had sessions when a person would go and do focal recordings at the group, where they would record the vocalizations and distance to the nearest neighbor during these focals that were about 10 minutes each, and from each group, individual in a group. And from that, we would compare them between the wet, dry, and extreme conditions. Okay. So what do we find? First off, we found that body condition indeed decreased from the wet to the extreme condition. You can really see that in the drought, the one extreme year we had, body condition was really low on weight gain, sorry. If we look at foraging success, which here is the weight gain from morning to lunch, you can see that there seems to be no change at all. And we were first quite puzzled until we realized there's two probable reasons. The first is that meerkats in normal wet or dry conditions don't forage until they're exploding. But when they're really satiated, they will start doing other behaviors. For example, going on sentinel and scanning for predators. And we know that they didn't do this in the extreme conditions because they just were there foraging for as long as they possibly could. And the other thing is that obviously we don't know what they foraged for. So while they might have eaten huge millipedes, so that makes the weight, they might not be very nutritious in the extreme period, and they wouldn't maybe eat them normally. So the weight might be the same, but the nutrition obviously will be very highly different. We found that a mean daily group speed indeed increased significantly from wet to extreme, but the effect is so small that it probably has no real important effect on what's going on in terms of understanding and hearing each other. The number of group splits increased, but it was higher both in the wet and extreme condition compared to the dry condition. But I want you to notice here that the proportion of group splits, even though it increased significantly, is still very, very low. So it means that even though conditions might not be that great, meerkats are exceptionally good at maintaining cohesion, which is really, really interesting. And then when we looked at the nearest neighbor distance, we can see that in the wet condition, individuals spend up more than 60% of the time within very close distance of 0 to 2 meters. And that this very close distance decreases from wet to extreme. It's still about 50% in extreme condition. And then the next distances increase. So 2 to 5 and 5 to 10 meters. So they space out, but they actually stay closer than expected. At least to the nearest neighbor. So what we here don't know is obviously how far the next neighbor is. So it might be that they just keep a single individual close to them. And if you look at the call rates, indeed we found that the call rate increased only for the drought condition, the extreme condition, sorry, but not for the other two. But we didn't find any difference in terms of the distance to the nearest neighbor. So it increased independent of that and was also the same for the other two. So that really seems that indeed there's little sound attenuation of the constraint spacing, probably in the dry conditions. In the wet condition, they seem to adjust the nearest neighbor distance by spending more time within very close distances rather than increasing the call rate. And in the extreme period, they seem to really increase the call rate rather than spacing because they spaced out slightly more. Obviously here, again, we only have the nearest neighbor distance and not actually the whole dispersion of the group, which would be really nice to have. In this project, one thing that we noticed, which is really sad, is that we don't really know the distribution of the food because we can't, as I said, we can't measure it. So another way to go about it is to actually make an agent-based model. So a lot of agent-based models in recent years were self-propelled particle models, and they're exceptionally good at describing the movement of schooling or flocking in groups, and they're usually based on alignment, attraction, and repulsion in specific zones. And basic assumptions are often visual contact among the individuals and there's very close proximity between them, making alignment one of the most important factors in these models. So if we think about the groups that I'm studying, like meerkats, for example, or animals foraging on the move, they're often, if you look at them, not necessarily aligned. and visual contact might not really be that great. Sorry. So here you have the meerkats. You might not actually see them that well, and they probably don't really see each other well either. So there's very little visual contact and accordingly very little alignment. So we thought of a model where we had attraction to food, because obviously groups move because they're attracted to resources, and attraction to the vocalizations of group members in order to maintain contact with them. And then we tried to fit this to real-world data of meerkats that I collected during my PhD. And then when once we had this model fitted, we changed the food density to really understand what happens, how does that affect the movement of the group. Okay, so the starting conditions of this model were that we had an area of 1.5 times 1.5 kilometers in model space. We distributed the individuals in a bivariate normal distribution around the center of this area. And then we distributed food in Poisson distributed clusters. And these clusters, where the reason for them is that in the Kalahari, food is probably more distributed around shrubs, which are really distributed in a very patchy kind of distribution. Within these clusters, we distributed a number of food items also within the Poisson distributions, sometimes more, sometimes less. And then in space, they were in a Gaussian distribution within the cluster. And that means that we had like 0.025 food items per square meter, but obviously in a cluster distribution. Okay. So when we have a meerkat, So if you have a meerkat, that it the first thing it does in this model is that it checks whether there is a food item within 30 centimeters. If there is, it will decide to eat the food item. And the food item has a, in terms of the size, has a time distribution, which is also a Poisson distribution. And here the eating time is including both the time it would take the meerkat in real life to dig it up, like scrabble for it, dig it up, process it, and then eat it. Well, when it's eating, it also has a certain probability to give a close call. And afterwards, the question is it still eating? If it's still eating, it will keep eating, and this process will continue until the food item is completely finished. And then it will move. I'll get to it in a minute, how individuals move. And also when it moves, it has a certain probability to call. And then it, again, if it's close to a food item, it will eat again. Okay, individuals move by having attention to the food items as well as calls of individuals. Here, the food items are small circles. The filled circles are uneaten food items, and empty circles are eaten food items. And that will be throughout this model chapter. So they have an attraction to every single uneaten food item, but the attraction depends on the distance to the food item, whereby they're attracted to median distant items. And that the reason for that is that if they get close to the food item, we wanted them to have a kind of a local search and not just straight go to the food item. And that we sum up, and then we get the attraction to food, the sum attraction to food, the same as for the attraction to calls. So they hear calls and then they will sum them up, and they will remember the last call of every single individual for a specific time. They're more attracted to calls from far away. The reason for this is that individuals that call right next to you, you have no reason to go to them because you probably actually, even a meerkat might have seen them. So it's more important if calls are a bit further away. However, the further away a call, the less likely the agents in our model are to hear these calls. And so from then we have the previous movement step of the individuals. And then from all this, we have the actual resulting movement step of a meerkat in this model. So then we had observation data that I collected during my PhD. And this data was collected through a 1 hertz GPS and microphone tags. So you can see on the left is the tags I had. They had a different system to attach in the end. And the right one is the fancy new tags that Ari has that actually work really nice. So my tags, the issue with them was that when you had them, you had to put them on the meerkat and they would start recording, and they would essentially until the battery lasted, which usually was for 7 hours, and then it was done. And that meant that it was really difficult to attach tags to every single group member at once. So instead we had 14 sessions and 6 groups where we had four individuals that we would follow with the observer. So we would go with the MyRUNS microphone setup, and we had the tag in the back, and we would have a proper microphone to record each individual. We would follow them. And then we would try at the same time before we started to get tags on as many individuals as possible. And yeah, and the individuals you followed were usually dominant pair and two subordinate individuals. Sorry, I'm mixing up the story here. Okay. And we managed to color 0 to 4 individuals depending which group we went to. So it was not quite as nice as is nowadays possible. So when we wanted to fit this model to the data, we had different parameters that we were looking at. And there's some group level parameters and individual level parameters. The group level parameters we looked at was the group cohesion. In this case, the longest distance between individual distance when there were no subgroups in the group. We had the group speed, which was the distance covered per 5 minutes by the group. The group spread, in this case, the deviation from the mean group location, and the group turning angle, again, in 5 minute segments. And then we had these individual parameters, which was the individual speed covered in 5 seconds, individual turning angle, again, 5 second segments, and then the nearest neighbor distance between individuals. So here you'll have a similarity comparison, where you have a comparison among simulations, between simulations observations, and among observations. And when we compare between simulations and observations, we took from the model, we usually model 12 individuals. We took as many individuals as we had in our data that we collected from the meerkat group. So if in the group that we observed, we only had 4 meerkats that we followed, then from the model, we only took out 4 individuals that we compared to. Okay, so here's the group level parameters, and you can see that the green one, which is among simulation comparisons, is always much higher together. And that's because it's an agent-based model, so they're more likely to be really similar. But you can also see that the brown one, which is the between simulation and observation, is actually fairly similar to the blue one, the among observation comparison. If you look at the individual parameters, again, we see a similar picture. The only one where there's a huge difference is the individual speed. And that's because in the simulation, the speeds were always much higher than in real life. But as we got all the other parameters quite well fitted, we decided to keep it as is. So overall, actually, the similarity between the fitted model and the data is quite good. So here's an example of the movement. So this is the movement of the data I collected with the tags. Here you have a group of 5 individuals that were tagged. And here's the simulated data for 12 individuals, where 5 individuals, no, actually all individuals, yeah, you can see. And the food items are in the back. And then here I have a model for you. Here, please note that the eaten food in this case is actually filled circles, and the other one, not eaten ones, are unfilled circles. So here you can see how this model actually works. So it does fairly well. It's quite nice. Okay, so then once we had the fitted model and we were pleased with what we had, we decided to change the resource abundance to less food. We decided in the model to do a stepwise reduction of food in terms of 20% less food, whereby we just changed the amount of food per cluster. We didn't change the actual clusters. When there's less food about, it's actually quite likely that individuals will pay less attention to the calls of conspecifics. And they might also call at higher rates. So the less attention is because they might get really hungry. So just pay attention to getting food rather than paying attention where everybody else is going. And as a response of that, seeing as what we found in the previous paper, we thought, okay, they maybe might increase the call rate to make themselves heard even though others pay less attention. So in the model, we simulated normal call rate and attention independent of the food reduction. Hunger, which meant that there's a reduced attention to the calls of conspecifics. We increased the call rate independent of hunger, and then we had hunger and a higher call rate. And then we compared this across group speed, a group spread, and number of subgroups to really understand how this affects the cohesion and coordination of the groups. So here in this next plot, you'll see the normal call rate in brown, hunger in red, high call rate in light blue, and hunger and call rate in dark blue. So first off, here's the group speed. And you can see here that if you have a normal call rate, but you have a food reduction of 0.20 to 80%, you can see that the group speed will actually decrease, which is the opposite of what we found in the real data, where there's a slight increase in group speed. This is usually because individuals got stuck. So if there's no food about at all, then individuals just got stuck in a foraging patch and might not manage to get to the next one. But you can see it's a quite low reduction. So if we have a higher call rate, it's exactly the same pattern. So high call rate in itself doesn't seem to really change anything. If we have a hunger, so individuals pay less attention to the calls of conspecifics, we can see that the effect is much stronger. So the group speed decreases much quicker. But if we then have an increase in call rate as well, it seems to really alleviate the effect unless there's really very little food about. So if we look at the group spread, you can see that again, high call rate and low call rate is the same. There's no effect of either, but increase in hunger, so paying less attention to conspecifics in red here, means that the group spread increases very strongly, even at very little increase decrease in food abundance. But again, calling at higher rates alleviates this, this hunger effect. And the same with the number of subgroups. So hunger will increase the number of subgroups because they just don't pay attention to each other, but then a higher call rate alleviates this effect, which is really nice. So to conclude, we found that we actually managed to get a realistic model for movement of animals foraging on the move, like for example, meerkats, owls, or baboons. The effect of food reduction was only there when individuals were hungry and so paid less attention to their conspecifics. And an increase in call rate seemed to alleviate this effect of paying less attention in the model, which is quite nice and seems to confirm what we found in the previous paper. So this model has a modular structure, and that's really nice because it allows an easy implementation of different assumptions. So in the model, as you've seen, we have, for example, the call rate is always the same across each individual. So we could, for example, implement a different call rate. We know that individuals call at different rates depending on where they are within the group. So we could implement this as a next step to really understand a bit more. We could also implement as different individuals that and might be able to discriminate. So we could implement a dominant female, and if the dominant female calls, individuals might respond in a slightly different way. Or if individuals find specific food items, they get really excited, they might then also affect the movement of other individuals more. So that's all things that could be implemented if we really wanted. And we can obviously change the food distribution if you work on a different species, this food is differently distributed. Okay, so with that, I want to finish this whole section of Maker at Work and come to my future plans at the Zukunftskolleg, which I'm really excited about. So this work is going to happen, as Ari already mentioned, together in her group and in collaboration with Joe Madden in Exeter, as well as Andy Radford in the University of Bristol. So if we have groups and they have to coordinate, I mentioned this before, one thing that is very rarely looked at, or at least it is looked at, but maybe not as strongly, is that there's individual differences in experience. And mostly this is looked at as individual personalities, for example, and slightly they might have different states, so there might be older individuals, dominant individuals, and so on, but it's not really clear how it really develops from the start to this experience. So for example, individuals might have grown up in small groups or big groups, and we know that group size can have a huge impact on for example, the cognition of animals. It's also known that the soundscape in which individuals grow up has a huge influence. So there's birds, I think it was in zebra finches, where just playing back calls when the chicks were still in the egg had a huge effect on later on their mating behavior. So individuals that heard incubation calls would be better, had a higher mating success than others, simply because they were able to incorporate the song types of other birds easier than the birds that didn't experience that kind of soundscape when in the egg. So I'm really interested in the ontogeny of the signals used for coordination and how that then affects how individuals are able to coordinate. Obviously, this is important to really look at the whole timeline of an individual, or at least over a specific period, so that you can really understand how this develops, which is a challenge, especially if you work with wild animals, and a reason why it hasn't really been studied to that extent. And obviously, it also brings in the problem that you, for coordination in general, you still want to know where individuals are and how they vocalize, and it's quite a difficult problem. But the hope is that technical advances allow it to be done in a better way. Sorry, I'm still also really interested in the mechanism of coordination, and especially how vocal communication is used for coordination, because there's only some studies that show some actual mechanism, like this vocal hotspot situation in the meerkats. But this is for groups that are super cohesive. Obviously, if you have fish and fusion dynamics or sexual segregation, there's a lot of other dynamics that might come in, and it becomes way more complicated. And people have studied vocal communication, how it's used for coordination, but I hope that really understanding the details of who's where, and also maybe how they, depending on their experience early on, how that affects how they coordinate and the mechanism. And lastly, I'm really interested in the consequence of coordination, because supposedly, if you're very good at coordinating, the reason you coordinate as a group is that you survive better and maybe are better able to reproduce. And otherwise, you might just get eaten. So the question is, what is the fitness consequence of efficient coordination? If you're very good at coordinating, that should increase your survival. And again, it's something that is very difficult to study, especially in the wild, especially if you have very long-lived groups. So I decided to study, or try to study this more likely, in the common pheasant. It's a large terrestrial game bird with strong sexual segregation. Here in this picture, it was breeding season, so you see them together, like at the moment, and if you go out, you might see them. In the winter, they will be in flocks, probably mostly males, mostly females. They will mix a bit, but it's rare. And they have varying group sizes as well, so the changes in composition and size. And then they have actually quite a large vocal repertoire, where it calls also depending on whether the chicks, so it changes by chick to adult, but also across the sexes, they have slightly different calls. And in the UK, what is very special is that they can rear and release pheasants in very large numbers. And they do this usually for shooting purposes, because there's a lot of people that like to eat pheasant, obviously, and want to shoot them. And the habitat in the UK is not that great for pheasants. So they have to rear and release them because they don't have that large stable population in the thing itself. And the released pheasants, if they're not shot, they usually actually don't live that long, simply because the habitat quality is not that great, and they're often predated within the first 3 months. So the group of Joe Madden has made use of the system by studying the cognition of pheasants and how, and these different effects where you can manipulate the pheasants when you rear them, and then you can release them and really see what the effect is when they have to engage in this actual environment. And I want to use the system too and really look at how it affects coordination. So specifically, I want to manipulate the early experience during development, starting from the egg. So I can rear eggs in incubators and then not only study how the eggs, for example, develop in terms of the sound and ontogeny, because it's actually really interesting in pheasants. When you have eggs together, because the chicks are supposed to hatch within a very small time frame to then run away with the mom, they coordinate already when they're in the egg. So they will make sounds to coordinate the hatching time. But also we know that whether they hear the calls of the mother hen or not, which she gives during incubation, has a strong effect of how they then understand the calls later on. This has only been studied for the first 5 days after hatching, so it's not really clear what the long-term effect of these calls is. In general, pheasant vocalizations are not very well studied, so we know very little. So I can essentially rear these eggs, manipulate them in terms of the soundscape, can study how they vocalize. And once the chicks hatch, I can put them into different groups. So I can have them experience small groups or big groups. And we know, for example, that sexual segregation in pheasants starts very early on when they're in chick stage. So obviously that will also be affected when they're in small groups or big groups. Maybe small groups, individuals might be eager to still maintain or be allow more harassment, for example, from the males, if you're female, than in a big group, simply because there's no other social partner around or very few. So once we have them in these groups, we can then actually look at the effects of early life experiences. for example, on the group movement and decision making, but also on group formation or dissolution, like also these sexual segregations and how they actually do things. And that means we can do also very nice experiments because we still keep them in lab conditions where we can do playback experiments to really understand the signal function and also how individuals understand the meaning of goals in time, because we will keep them in like rhythm until they're about 10 weeks of age. So we can do experiments also multiple times to really see how their behavior changes. And also depending on what their early experience is, we can also give them coordination tasks of really trying to understand how they make decisions. And again, how that depends on these early experiences. During this time, we can do video observations and vocal recordings where we will try to really get detailed information of who's calling, how they're moving, and so on. And then once we release them at 10 weeks of age, we can attach biologging technology on them. And for example, they already have an established system of Atlas tags that we can use. So we'll get the GPS, the positioning of the individuals, but we can also add accelerometers and microphones to really understand who is where, when are they calling, what are they doing. And then we could still do specific playback experiments, for example, playing back a predator to see how they then coordinate. And then finally, we can actually, because they will be predated very quickly, which is sad, but actually really exciting at the same time, we can get the consequence of like how depending on what the early experience was, what is the survival chance of these individuals? How does it affect them? And hopefully we find some sort of measure of efficient coordination, which I'm still not exactly sure how to measure that, but it would be really nice to know or find a nice way and then see how that affects it. And obviously the most interesting thing is to find out which are the individuals that survive. So because the pheasants, to study them, to do a field season this year already, is difficult because I would have had to start about a month ago and I haven't even officially started yet. We decided to do a pilot study on chicken. And that's really nice because the point with chicken is that you can get them at any time in the year. Obviously, we won't be able to release them, so it will be only in the chick stage. The pheasants, we would have to start now because we have to bring them in such a life cycle that they can still come back and really, if they survive, really get used to and then do the normal winter stuff. And yeah. So with the chicken, the idea is that we will rear them from eggs to 3 to 4 weeks of age. Again, we'll try to manipulate the soundscape and group size and then do playbacks to really understand how the function of the calls is and so on. And we can still also do other decision-making experiments. And this will be really nice to really test the equipment and the setup and really get a really nice experimental design, because as you might have noticed, the pheasant study is really timed. So there's a lot of things to do in very little time. So I think this pilot study will really help to clarify what we can actually do and to pinpoint when and how things have to be done. And I hope to start this rather soon, so toward mid-June, latest. Okay, and for this, what I really need urgently at the moment is the maternal calls of pheasant and chicken. So if you have a brooding chicken or you know someone that breeds pheasants, that would be obviously great if you could come and talk to me about it. And with that, I want to thank you for your attention. And if you have questions, I'm very happy to take them.
Hi, Ginny. Nice talk. Nice experiments that you've got going on, actually, quite a bit. I want to go all the way back to the beginning of your talk, to when you were making your model of movement for the meerkats. When you say that you had an attention to food, what is that? So you're assuming that they can see food already, or they know where food could exist, or that even there could be a social element to that attraction?
So there probably is a bit of a social element, but we know that, so I don't know, from just personal observation, I would say meerkats are quite good at going to a patch. So for example, they might go under a shrub and then start sniffing around and scrabbling under a shrub. So that they would see from further away, for example, the specific shrub patch. And then within the shrub, when they get close, then we had this kind of more local search because they become less attracted. And then, then they would just yeah, hopefully just start searching, like sniffing stuff out. But usually what happens in a real maker, they will scratch and they'll stuff their nose into the sand, and then if they don't sniff anything, they'll keep going.
So how do you disentangle a vocalization that is some cohesion cue rather than a vocal stimulus for, hey, I've found some food, come and join me?
In the meerkats, the I find some food, please come and join me doesn't really happen. It's like, stay away. They're super competitive for food. Obviously, meerkats might use the vocalizations of other individuals to take it as a cue. There might be food. And that's where it might come in to change the parameters in the model. For example, when you have a dominant individual, she's the most competitive individual, the female. So she might definitely take the excited calling of an individual when it finds food as a cue to go there and again compete. And also in our model, we didn't actually, some individuals, when they find a food item, especially if they dug quite a lot for it, so it was a scorpion and they have to dig a long time to actually get it, they will start calling a lot. And that might obviously have different reasons. It might be because they become super excited because they know, now there's a really amazing food item. But it might also be that they want to start trying to keep the group with them so they don't get lost, because it takes them that long to find the food item. But obviously all the other individuals can use that as a cue to say, okay, this individual is digging out the scorpion, so if I come in at the right moment, I can just snatch it from it without having had to do the work. That's things that could be implemented, but we didn't. So we just wanted to have a baseline to really understand, basically, with very simple rules, does it still work? Yeah.
Nice. Thank you.
I have a question about the predation. How do you plan to identify a specific individual that was predated?
Well, the thing is that they will have the tags. So they will have the Atlas tags. And so far, like, they had already deployed them previously in like previous years. And it seems that it's quite easy to see that an individual was predated simply by looking at the tag data and it's not moving anymore. We won't know who predated the individual. Maybe there might be some cues of what predated it, but I'm not quite sure how easy that will be to identify when you find feathers or scats or something of the predator.
Okay, so it's not just the signal is not just you don't see it anymore, but you see just the remains of the tag. I understand it correctly?
Well, yeah, I mean, the tag, technically, they shouldn't eat the tag. So from what I understand from Joe, who had this previously, and they retrieved all the tags again, but they could already see an individual is predated because it sends the data back. So you can see it directly, essentially, live. So that should allow to just see, okay, an individual was predated, and then you go and try to find the tag. But again, I don't know, like, I'm not quite sure how easy it will be to identify who predated it or...
Yeah, from my experience with the Atlas, the tags might just disappear without any relation to death.
Okay.
And also, it's only in a limited area, so the individual might just go to a different area.
Yeah, though the pheasants are not actually, they're quite resident, essentially, in their movement. So I think that will make it easier. And then the other thing I hope is that we will have, my hope is that we can use Vesper tags for the microphone and accelerometer, and they also have a GPS so that we get that finer signal additionally as well to just see in case they do move out, we have additional. Yeah.
Nice, great talk.
Hi, I might have a question. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much for the talk. Really, really interesting, really exciting. And I wanted to go back to the beginning of your talk and when you were conducting the playback experiments and you saw that you were breaking cohesion a little bit, but then you had sort of a recovery of cohesion. And I thought that was really interesting. And I was wondering if you were able to actually analyze a little bit that recovering part and realize that, or maybe figure out when the animals were, you know, going back to a more cohesive group. Were you able to identify who was calling and what types of calling were being emitted? And because that, it seems like you provoked it, you broke the group, but then the group came back together and it was like two experiments in one, right? So that was really interesting. So I was wondering if you were able to analyze sort of that recovery period and realize who were the focal call, where the focal caller was, etc.
So I don't know who called, because usually that was very difficult to see. What they usually emitted was an alarm call. So we don't really know whether the alarm called because they were separate or whether actually something happened and then the alarm called. And they might have just been slightly more on edge because, for example, there's some days when it was really windy, so they're already, the group is more on edge than usual. You do your playback. I mean, it's a difficult condition. But that's the thing. It's like we only had 8 groups where we did it. So I think the sample size to really understand how this recovery thing, especially because it didn't happen every time. So sometimes they would just maybe not disperse as far and then just slowly meander back because they heard. Obviously, the makers are still calling themselves as well. So there's a lot of small things going on that, yeah. But I think if they really came rapidly back together, it was because there was an alarm call by one individual in one of the subgroups and they would run back to a bolt hole in the middle.
Thank you so much. Very interesting talk.
I had a question about, you said that when individuals got further away from each other or from the group, they increased the call rate. So that made me think of, do they only increase the call rate or do they also change other aspects of the vocalizations? For instance, how loud they call, because if you're so far away from the group and you're increasing the call rate, it may not really help, right? And I guess my other question was, are they always calling or are they always within earshot of each other, basically?
So first with the increase of the call rate. So there was a master's student and she observed that if they get further than 10 meters away, they might slightly increase the call rate, which is probably just by 2 or 3 calls a minute more than before. So it's not a lot. If they get really out of earshot, like really far away and they don't see other meerkats anymore, they will change the call type. And then they give these lost calls, which is a very loud, actually vocalizations. And really, you can really hear the panic of the meerkat in the call. Like it's really stressed out and very noisy call. We know that when there's wind conditions or like when there's specific environment conditions, when it's difficult to hear, for example, it's very windy, they will increase the call rate, the call volume. So they will call louder. I'm not so quite sure about the structure because I personally haven't really looked at it. How they change the structure of the calls, but they probably adapt the structure of the calls as well to specific conditions in the environment. Also, for example, another very noisy condition is when pups are around. So when there's pups in the groups, they beg the whole time and they're very loud. So all the other meerkats will just use the pups as where the group is, because where the pups are, that's where the group is.
Right.
You had another thing, right? Sorry.
Yeah, which was, are they, I mean, so in the typical group, is each individual able to hear the most furthest individual, for instance? Like
probably not necessarily. It depends, I would say. So if the group is really small and they stay close together, they might disperse over 20 meters in distance, but that's a really small group. And the thing is, we don't actually know how far a maker can hear a close call. The close call is a soft vocalization, so it's actually very low in volume. So I would say probably not, even in the smaller groups, unless they're really close together. The bigger groups, they can disperse up to 80 meters. And it might be 30 individuals really far dispersed from the last to the first one. Obviously, the nearest neighbor will still be very close together, but that's what I mean. They might build these kind of slightly subgroups within the group. They won't hear each other from the front or the back or the sides, essentially.
So it's a sort of semi-local signal.
I would say it's a semi-local signal, but again, we don't have a lot of information how far they can hear each other. I think there's still a postdoc in Zurich who was actually trying to find out how far they can hear each other, depending on the conditions and the environment, whether it's dune or not a dune, all these kind of things.
Thanks.
That would be really interesting to know.
Yeah, hi. Nice talk. Very interesting. Did you or Ari ever thought about having meerkats in like in lab conditions and analyze behavior in lab conditions?
So in Zurich, there is a group kept in lab conditions, and it's really difficult to deal with meerkats in the lab. The problem is, so there's multiple problems. One is that they become extremely food fixed. But on the other hand, makers are not really, you know, you can, they try to do cognitive experiments and then use food as a thing, but they're, for example, doing like pulling, like trying, yeah, the where you help each other for food, which you do a lot with other experiments, like the pulling experiments, bees and mice and everything. But they're not the kind of food sharing individuals. So they get very aggressive and very competitive. That's one problem. And in the Kalahari, you don't have that because they're habituated to your presence, but they don't expect anything from you, really, unless you have the scales out and you want to weigh them. And then they get a tiny amount of food. The other problem is that, actually, that's the major problem, is that you cannot keep a lot of meerkats. So we have one group of meerkats, but from a specific age on. So when the males start to be 1 year old, they want to disperse. And then what do you do with these dispersers? Because they will just essentially, you have to at some point separate them from the group. But then if you have another group nearby, they're super territorial. So they start fighting and they can smell each other. So the group is continuously stressed out. And that again makes it really difficult to do any useful experiment with meerkats in the lab, because just in the terms of how you can keep them. And it's being tried to get these subordinate males that want to disperse, and maybe the females, they do also sometimes fight to somehow get something with zoos that you can get one from there, bring one over and so on. But it's a very difficult and very time consuming thing with very little, at least from my perspective, that's my personal view. So other people might have different views, I don't know, on the benefits. I feel like it's a lot, very time consuming, and doesn't really allow you to do much in the end that you can't really do in the Kalahari better just with pure habituation of the wild groups. I don't know.
Cool, thanks.
Any more questions?
Can I just ask you to tell us a little bit more, I don't know how much is really known about this, but about the vocal repertoire of pheasants, and about how similar you think it's going to be to the meerkat situation, and what's going to be really different about it. Also, okay. The coordination, I guess, but.
Yeah, so the vocalizations of the pheasants, there is a paper that sums the repertoire, but obviously, for example, already doesn't mention the incubation call. So I don't know how complete that paper is, because it's been done in, like, I don't know, in the 70s or something, as most papers on pheasant vocalizations. So there's one describing the repertoire and then describing a function for each call, but not actually having tested it, from what I understand. And then there's a couple of papers that look at these calls, the incubation calls of the mother and the calls from the chicks within the eggs, and all these kind of interactions when they, with the hatching coordination. And that's essentially everything known about pheasant vocalizations. So it's not a lot. What is definitely different from the pheasants to other like species I've worked on is that they have these calls depending on the sex. So I'm used to meerkats where every individual can give essentially the same calls, and it's not sex dependent or age dependent. Well, it's kind of age dependent, because obviously bagging is only given by pups. And in the pheasants, you have this age dependence and the sex dependence, where they have calls specific by sex, which for me is unusual, but I guess a lot of the bird people are like, well, that's obvious. I mean, it happens all the time. So yeah, that will make a difference just for me to understand what's going on. Yeah, what was the other part? Sorry.
Just thinking about sort of the interaction between the vocalizations and the coordination, like whether you expect there to be some parallels, like with maybe contact calls or something, or what you expect to be quite different.
Yeah, so I think the issue is that they're very efficient fusion groups. So I think most of the coordination would happen in winter when they're in flocks. And it would be probably really interesting, obviously, just to study that in the wild, when you have the female flocks or you have the male flocks, because I guess that because they have different call types as well, they might use different things and do different things. They might also stay within very close visual proximity. So I'm not actually sure how much they use vocalizations for this. I know the female, when she has chicks, they use a lot of vocalizations as a flocking kind of come to me, follow me kind of calls, but then it's a very kind of dominant individual making the decision and all the chicks are following. In my lab experiments section, I don't have the hen, so they will have to come up with some sort of coordination without this domineering mother that decides where to go. I don't know. It's difficult because I really don't know much about how they vocalize. And I think in chicken themselves is also, it's not quite as well known because they mostly study more the physiology rather than the vocalizations. And if the vocalizations, again, is more within the chicks and the hatching and things, as far as I understand. Yeah. But I'm still reading the literature. So if anyone has knowledge on these kind of things, please send it my way. That would be super nice.